This is Audible.
Harper Audio presents The Roundhouse by Louise Erdrich, performed by Gary Farmer. To Paulus. Chapter 1, 1988. Small trees had attacked my parents' house at the foundation. They were just seedlings with one or two rigid, healthy leaves. Nevertheless, the stocky shoots had managed to squeeze through knife cracks in the decorative brown shingles covering the cement blocks. They had grown into the unseen wall, and it was difficult to pry them loose. My father wiped his palm across his forehead and damned their toughness. I was using a rusted old dandelion fork with a splintered handle. He wielded a long, slim iron fireplace poker that was probably doing more harm than good. As my father prodded away blindly at the places where he sensed roots might have penetrated, he was surely making convenient holes in the mortar for next year's seedlings. Whenever I succeeded in working loose a tiny tree, I placed it like a trophy beside me on the narrow sidewalk that surrounded the house. There were ash shoots, elm, maple, box elder, even a good-sized catalpa, which my father placed in an ice cream bucket and watered, thinking that he might find a place to replant it. I thought it was a wonder the treelets had persisted through a North Dakota winter. They had water, perhaps, but only feeble light and a few crumbs of earth. Yet each seed had managed to sink the hasp of a root deep and a probing tendril outward. My father stood, stretching his sore back. "That's enough," he said, though he was usually a perfectionist. I was unwilling to stop, however. And after he went into the house to phone my mother, who had gone to her office to pick up a file, I continued to pry at the hidden rootlings. He did not come back out, and I thought he must have lain down for a nap, as he did now sometimes. You would think then that I would have stopped, a 13-year-old boy with better things to do. But on the contrary, as the afternoon passed and everything on the reservation grew quiet and hushed, it seemed increasingly important to me that each one of these invaders be removed down to the very tip of the root, where all the vital growth was concentrated. And it seemed important as well that I do a meticulous job, as opposed to so many of my shoddily completed chores. Even now, I wonder at the steepness of my focus. I wedged my iron fork close as I could along the length of the twig-like sprout. Each little tree required its own singular strategy. It was almost impossible not to break off the plant before its roots could be drawn intact from their stubborn hiding place. I quit at last, sneaked inside, and slipped into my father's study. I took out the law book my father called the Bible, Felix S. Komen's Handbook of Federal Indian Law. It had been given to my father by his father. The rust-red binding was scraped, the long spine cracked, and every page bore handwritten comments. I was trying to get used to the old-fashioned language and constant footnotes. Either my father or my grandfather had placed an exclamation point on page 38, beside the italicized case, which had naturally interested me also. United States versus 43 gallons of whiskey. I suppose one of them had thought that the title was ridiculous, as I did. Nevertheless, I was parsing out the idea. Established in other cases and reinforced in this one, that our treaties with the government were like treaties with foreign nations. That the grandeur and power my mushum talked about wasn't entirely lost. As it was, at least to some degree I meant to know, still protected by the law. I was reading and drinking a glass of cool water in the kitchen when my father came out of his nap and entered, disoriented and yawning. For all of its importance, Cohen's handbook was not a heavy book, and when he appeared, I drew it quickly onto my lap, under the table. My father licked his dry lips and cast about, searching for the smell of food, perhaps, the sound of pots or the clinking of glasses or footsteps. What he said then surprised me. Although on the face of it, his words seemed slight. Where is your mother? His voice was hoarse and dry. I slid the book onto another chair, rose, and handed him a glass of water. He gulped it down. He didn't say those words again, but the two of us stared at each other in a way that struck me somehow as adult, as though he knew that by reading his law book I had inserted myself into his world. His look persisted until I dropped my eyes. I had actually just turned 13. 2 weeks ago, I'd been 12. At work, I said, to break his gaze. I had assumed that he knew where she was, that he'd got the information when he phoned. I knew she was not really at work. She had answered a telephone call and then told me that she was going into her office to pick up a folder or two. A tribal enrollment specialist, she was probably mulling over some petition she'd been handed. She was the head of a department of one. It was a Sunday, thus the hush, the Sunday afternoon suspension. Even if she'd gone to her sister Clements's house to visit afterward, Mom would have returned by now to start dinner. We both knew that. Women don't realize how much store men set on the regularity of their habits. We absorb their comings and goings into our bodies, their rhythms into our bones. Our pulse is set to theirs. As always, on a weekend afternoon, we were waiting for my mother to start us ticking away on the evening. And so, you see, her absence stopped time. What should we do, we both said at once, which was again upsetting, but at least my father, seeing me unnerved, took charge. Let's go find her, he said. And even then, as I threw on my jacket, I was glad that he was so definite. Find her. Not just look for her, not search. We would go out and find her. The cars had a flat, he declared. She probably drove someone home, and the cars had a flat. These damn roads. We'll walk down and borrow your uncle's car and go find her. Find her again. I strode along beside him. He was quick and still powerful once he got going. He had become a lawyer, then a judge, and also married late in life. I was a surprise to my mother, too. My old mushum called me Oops. That was his nickname for me, and unfortunately others in the family found it funny. So I am sometimes called Oops to this very day. We went down the hill to my aunt and uncle's house, a pale green HUD house sheltered by cottonwood and gentrified by three small blue spruce trees. Mushum lived there, too, in a timeless fog. We were all proud of his super longevity. He was ancient, but still active in the upkeep of the yard. Each day after his exertions outside, he lay by the window on a cot to rest, a pile of sticks, lightly dozing, sometimes emitting a dry, sputtering sound that was probably laughter. When my father told Clements and Edward that my mother had had a flat and we needed their car, as if he actually had knowledge of this mythical flat tire, I almost laughed. He seemed to have convinced himself of the truth of his speculation. We backed down the gravel drive in my uncle's Chevrolet and drove to the tribal offices circled the parking lot, empty, windows dark. As we came back out the entrance, we turned right. "She went to hoop dance, I'll bet," said my father. "Needed something for dinner. Maybe she was going to surprise us, Joe." I am the second Anton Basil Coutts, but I'd fight anyone who put a junior in back of my name, or a number, or called me Basil. I decided I was Joe when I was 6. When I was 8, I realized that I'd chosen the name of my great-grandfather Joseph. I knew him mainly as the author of inscriptions and books, with amber pages and dry leather bindings. He passed down several shelves of these antiquities. I resented the fact that I didn't have a brand new name to distinguish me from the tedious Coots line. Responsible, upright, even offhandedly heroic men who drank quietly, smoked an occasional cigar, drove a sensible car, and only showed their mettle by marrying smarter women. I saw myself as different, though I didn't know how yet. Even then, tamping down my anxiety as we went looking for my mother, who had gone to the grocery store. Just that, surely a little errand. I was aware that what was happening was in the nature of something unusual. A missing mother. A thing that didn't happen to the son of a judge, even one who lived on a reservation. In a vague way, I hoped something was going to happen. I was the sort of kid who spent a Sunday afternoon prying little trees out of the foundation of his parents' house. I should have given in to the inevitable truth that this was the sort of person I would become, in the end. But I kept fighting it. Yet when I say that I wanted there to be something. I mean nothing bad, but something. A rare occurrence. A sighting. A bingo win. Through Sunday was not bingo day, and it would have been completely out of character for my mother to play. That's what I wanted. Though something out of the ordinary. Only that. Halfway to hoop dance, it occurred to me that the grocery store was closed on Sunday. "Of course it is," my father's chin jutted, his hands tightened on the wheel. He had a profile that would look Indian on a movie poster, Roman on a coin. There was a classic stoicism in his heavy beak and jaw. He kept driving because, he said, she might have forgotten it was Sunday, too. Which was when we passed her, there. She whizzed by us in the other lane, riveted. Driving over the speed limit, anxious to get back home to us. But here we were. We laughed at her set face as we did a U-turn there on the highway and followed her, eating her dust. "She's mad," my father laughed, so relieved. "See, I told you." "She forgot. Went to the grocery and forgot it was closed. Mad now she wasted gas. Oh, Geraldine." There was amusement, adoration, amazement in his voice when he said those words. "Oh, Geraldine." Just from those two words, it was clear that he was and had always been in love with my mother. He had never stopped being grateful that she had married him and right afterward given him a son, when he'd come to believe he was the end of the line. "Oh, Geraldine." He shook his head, smiling as we drove along, and everything was all right. More than all right. We could now admit we had been worried by my mother's uncharacteristic absence. We could be jolted into a fresh awareness of how we valued the sanctity of small routine. While, though I saw myself in the mirror, in my thoughts, I valued such ordinary pleasures. So it was our turn then. To worry her just a little, said my father. Just to let her in for a taste of her own medicine. We took our time bringing the car back to Clements's house and walked up the hill, anticipating my mother's indignant question. "Where were you?" I could just see her hands knuckled on her hips, her smile twitching to jump from behind her frown. She'd laugh when she heard the story. We walked up the dirt driveway, alongside it in a strict row. Mom had planted the pansy seedlings she'd grown in paper milk cartons. She'd put them out early, the only flower that could stand the frost. As we came up the drive, we saw that she was still in the car, sitting in the driver's seat before the blank wall of the garage door. My father started running. I could see it, too, in the set of her body, something fixed, rigid, wrong. When he got to the car, he opened the driver's side door. Her hands were clenched on the wheel, and she was staring blandly ahead, as she had been when we passed her going the opposite way on the road to hoop dance. We'd seen her intense stare, and we laughed then. She's mad at the wasted gas. I was just behind my father, careful even then to step over the scalloped pansy leaves and buds. He put his hands on hers and carefully pried her fingers off the steering wheel. Cradling her elbows, he lifted her from the car and supported her as she shifted toward him, still bent in the shape of the car seat. She slumped against him, stared past me. There was vomit down the front of her dress and soaking her skirt and soaking the gray cloth of the car seat, her dark blood. "Go down to Clements," said my father. "Go down there and say I am taking your mother straight to the hoop dance emergency. Tell them to follow." With one hand, he opened the door to the back seat, and then, as though they were dancing in some awful way, he maneuvered Mom to the edge of the seat and very slowly laid her back. Helped her turn over on her side. She was silent, though now she moistened her cracked, bleeding lips with the tip of her tongue. I saw her blink, a little frown. Her face was beginning to swell. I went around to the other side and got in with her. I lifted her head and slid my leg underneath. I sat with her, holding my arm over her shoulder. She vibrated with a steady shudder, like a switch had been flipped inside. A strong smell rose from her, the vomit, and something else like gas or kerosene. "I'll drop you off down there," my father said, backing out, the car tires screeching. "No, I'm coming too. I've got to hold on to her. We'll call from the hospital." I had almost never challenged my father in word or deed, but it didn't even register between us. There had already been that look, odd, as if between two grown men, and I had not been ready, which didn't matter. I was holding my mother tightly now in the back seat of the car. Her blood was on me. I reached onto the back window ledge and pulled down the old plaid quilt we kept there. She was shaking so bad I was scared she would fly apart. "Hurry, Dad." "All right," he said. And then we flew there. He had the car up past 90. We just flew. My father had a voice that could thunder out. It was said he had developed this. It was not a thing he had in his youth, but he'd had to use it in the courtroom. His voice did thunder out and fill the emergency entrance. Once the attendants had my mother on a gurney, my father told me to call Clements, then wait. Now that his anger was the thing filling the air, crackling clean, I was better. Whatever had happened would be fixed because of his fury, which was a rare thing and got results. He held my mother's hand as they wheeled her into the emergency ward. The doors closed behind them. I sat down in a chair of orange molded plastic. A skinny pregnant woman had walked past the open car door eyeing my mother, taking it all in before she registered herself. She slumped down next to a quiet old woman across from me and picked up an old People magazine. "Don't you Indians have your own hospital over there? Aren't you building a new one?" "The emergency room's under construction," I told her. "Still," she said. "Still what?" I made my voice grating and sarcastic. I was never like so many Indian boys, who'd look down, quiet in their anger, and say nothing. My mother had taught me different. The pregnant woman pursed her lips and looked back at her magazine. The old woman was knitting the thumb of a mitten. I went over to the payphone, but I didn't have any money. I went to the nurse's window, asked to use the phone. We were close enough for the call to be loco, so the nurse let me use it, but there was no answer. So I knew my aunt had taken Edward up to adore the sacrament, which got them out of the house on Sunday nights. He said that while Clements adored the sacrament, he meditated on how it could be possible that humans had evolved out of apes only to sit gaping at a round white cracker. Uncle Edward was a science teacher. I sat back down in the waiting room, as far from the pregnant lady as I could get, but the room was very small, so that wasn't far enough. She was thumbing through the magazine. Cher was on the cover. I could read the words beside Cher's jaw. She's made Moonstruck a mega hit. Her lover is 23, and she's tough enough to say, "Mess with me and I'll kill you." But Cher did not look tough. She looked like a surprise plastic doll. The bony, bulgy woman peeked around Cher and spoke to the knitting lady. "Looked like that poor woman had a miscarriage, or maybe," her voice went sly, "a rape." The woman's lip lifted off her rabbit teeth as she looked at me. Her ratty yellow hair quivered. I looked right back into her lashless hazel eyes, but I did something odd by instinct. I went over and took the magazine out of her hands. Still staring at her, I tore off the cover and dropped the rest of the magazine. I ripped again. Cher's identical eyebrows parted. The lady who was knitting pursed her lips, counting stitches. I gave the cover back, and the woman accepted the pieces. Then suddenly I felt bad about Cher. What had she done to me? I got up and walked out the door. I stood outside. I could hear the woman's voice, raised, triumphant, complaining to the nurse. The sun was almost down. The air had gone cold, and with the darkness, a stealthy chill entered me. I hopped up and down and swung my arms. I didn't care what. I was not going back in until that woman was gone or until my father came out and told me that my mother was all right. I could not stop thinking about what that woman had said. Those two words stabbed my thoughts, as she had meant them to do, miscarriage. A word I didn't altogether understand, but knew it had to do with babies, which I knew were impossible. My mother had told me 6 years before, when I'd pestered her for a brother, that the doctor had made sure that after me she could not get pregnant. It just could not happen. So that left the other word. After a while, I saw a nurse take the pregnant lady back in through the emergency doors. I hoped they would not put her anywhere near my mother. I went in and again called my aunt, who said that she'd leave Edward to watch Mushaman drive right over. She also asked me what had happened. What was wrong? "Mom's bleeding," I said. My throat shut and I couldn't say more. "She's hurt? Was there an accident?" I got it out that I didn't know, and Clements hung up. A poker-faced nurse came out and told me to go back to my mother. The nurse disapproved that my mother had asked for me. "Insisted," she said. I wanted to run ahead, but I followed the nurse down a bright-lit hall, into a windowless room lined with green-glass-fronted metal cabinets. The room had been dimmed, and my mother was wearing a flimsy hospital gown. A sheet was tucked around her legs. There was no blood anywhere. My father was standing at the head of her bed, his hand on the metal rail of the headboard. At first, I didn't look at him, just at her. My mother was a beautiful woman. That's something I always knew. A given among family, among strangers. She and Clements had coffee cream skin, and hot black glossy curls. slim even after their children. Calm and direct, with take-charge eyes and movie star lips. When overcome with laughter, they lost all dignity, however, and choked, snorted, burped, wheezed, even farted, which made them ever more hysterical. They usually sent each other into fits, but sometimes my father, too, could make them lose control. Even then, they were beautiful. Now I saw my mother's face, puffed with welts and distorted to an ugly shape. She peered through slits in the swollen flesh of her lids. "What happened?" I asked stupidly. She didn't answer. Tears leaked from the corners of her eyes. She blotted them away with a gauze-wrapped fist. "I'm all right, Joe. Look at me, see?" And I looked at her, but she was not all right. There were scrapes of blows and the awful lopsidedness. Her skin had lost its normal warm color. It was gray as ash. Her lips were seamed with dried blood. The nurse came in, raised the end of the bed with a crank, laid another blanket over her. I hung my head and leaned toward her. I tried to stroke her wrapped wrist and cold, dry fingertips. With a cry, she snatched her hand away as though I'd hurt her. She went rigid and closed her eyes. This action devastated me. I looked up at my father, and he gestured for me to come to him. He put his arm around me, walked me out of the room. "She's not all right," I said. He looked down at his watch and then back at me. His face registered the humming rage of a man who couldn't think fast enough. "She's not all right." I spoke as if to tell him an urgent truth, and for a moment I thought he'd break. I could see something rising in him, but he conquered it, breathed out, and gathered himself. "Joe?" He was looking strangely at his watch again. "Joe?" he said, "your mother was attacked." We stood in the hallway together under patchy, buzzing, fluorescent lights. I said the first thing I thought of. "By who? Attacked by who?" Absurdly, we both realized that my father's usual response would have been to correct my grammar. We looked at each other, and he said nothing. My father has the head, neck, and shoulders of a tall and powerful man. But the rest of him is perfectly average, even a little clumsy and soft. If you'd think about it, this is a good physique to have as a judge. He looms imposingly seated at the bench, but when conferring in his chambers, a glorified broom closet, he is non-threatening and people trust him. As well as thunderous, his voice is capable of every nuance and sometimes very gentle. It was the gentleness in his voice now that scared me, and the softness, almost a whisper. "She doesn't know who the man was, Joe." "But will we find him?" I asked in that same hushed voice. "We will find him," my father said. "And then what?" My father never shaved on Sundays, and a few tiny stubbles of gray beard showed. That thing in him was gathering again, ready to burst out, but instead he put his hands on my shoulders and spoke with that reedy softness that spooked me. "I can't think that far ahead right now." I put my hands on his hands and looked into his eyes, his leveling brown eyes. I wanted to know that whoever had attacked my mother would be found, punished, and killed. My father saw this, his fingers bit into my shoulders. "We'll get him," I said quickly. I was fearful as I said this, dizzy. "Yes." He took his hands away. "Yes," he said again. He tapped his watch, bit down on his lip. "Now, if the police would come, they need to get a statement. They should have been here." We turned to go back to the room. "Which police?" I asked. "Exactly," he said. The nurse didn't want us back in the room yet, and as we stood waiting, the police arrived. Three men came through the emergency ward doors and stood quietly in the hall. There was a state trooper, an officer local to the town of Hoopdance, and Vince Medwason from the tribal police. My father had insisted that they each take a statement from my mother because it wasn't clear where the crime had been committed, on state or tribal land, or who had committed it, an Indian or a non-Indian. I already knew, in a rudimentary way, that these questions would swirl around the facts. I already knew, too, that these questions would not change the facts, but they would inevitably change the way we sought justice. My father touched my shoulder before he left me and approached them. I stood against the wall. They were all slightly taller than my father, but they knew him and leaned down close to hear his words. They listened to him intently, their eyes not leaving his face. As he spoke, he looked down at the floor occasionally and folded his hands behind his back. He looked at each of them in turn from under his brows, then cast his eyes down at the floor again. Each police officer went into the room with a notebook and a pen, and came out again in about 15 minutes, expressionless. Each shook my father's hand and swiftly exited. A young doctor named Egg was on duty that day. He was the one who had examined my mother. As my father and I were going back to Mom's room, we saw that Dr. Egg had returned. "I don't suggest that the boy," he began. I thought it was funny that his dome-balding, shiny head was eggish, like his name. His oval face with the little round black eyeglasses looked familiar, and I realized it was the sort of face my mother used to draw on boiled eggs so that I would eat them. "My wife insisted on seeing Joe again," my father told Dr. Egg. "She needs him to see that she is all right." Dr. Egg was silent. He gave my father a prim little piercing look. My father stepped back from Egg and asked me to go out into the waiting room to see if Clements had arrived yet. "I'd like to see Mom again." "I'll come get you," said my father urgently. "Go." Dr. Egg was staring even harder at my father. I turned away from them with sick reluctance as my father and Dr. Egg walked away from me. They spoke in low voices. I didn't want to leave, so I turned and watched them before I went out into the waiting room. They stopped outside my mother's room. Dr. Egg finished speaking and jabbed his eyeglasses up his nose with one finger. My father walked to the wall as if he were going through it. He pressed his forehead and hands against the wall and stood there with his eyes shut. Dr. Egg turned and saw me frozen at the doors. He pointed toward the waiting room. My father's emotion was something. His gesture implied that I was too young to witness. But during the last few hours, I had become increasingly resistant to authority. Instead of politely vanishing, I ran to my father. Flailing Dr. Egg aside, I threw my arms around my father's soft torso, held him under his jacket, and I fiercely clung to him, saying nothing, only breathing with him, taking great, deep sobs of air. Much later, after I had gone into law and gone back and examined every document I could find, every statement, relived every moment of that day and the days that followed, I understood that this was when my father had learned from Dr. Egg the details and extent of my mother's injuries. But that day, all I knew, after Clement separated me from my father and led me away, was that the hallway was a steep incline. I went back through the doors and let Clements talk to my father. After I'd sat for about half an hour in the waiting room, Clements came in and told me that my mother was going into surgery. She held my hand. We sat together staring at a picture of a pioneer woman sitting in a hot hillside with her baby lying next to her, shaded beneath a black umbrella. We agreed that we had never really cared for the picture, and now we were going to actively hate it. Though, this was not the picture's fault. "I should take you home. Let you sleep in Joseph's room," said Clements. "You can go to school tomorrow from our house. I'll come back here and wait." I was tired. My brain hurt. but I looked at her like she was crazy, because she was crazy to think that I would go to school. Nothing would go on as normal. That steeply inclined hallway led to this place, the waiting room, where I would wait. "You could at least sleep," said Aunt Clements. "It wouldn't hurt to sleep. The time would pass, and you wouldn't have to stare at that damn picture." "Was it rape?" I asked her. "Yes," she said. "There was something else," I said. My family doesn't hedge about things. Though Catholic, my aunt was not one to let butter melt in her mouth. When she spoke, answering me, her voice was quick and cool. "Rape is forced sex. A man can force a woman to have sex. That's what happened." I nodded. "But I wanted to know something else. Will she die from it?" "No," said Clements immediately. "She won't die, but sometimes..." She bit down on her lips from the inside, so they made a frowning line, and she squinted at the picture. "It's more complicated," she said finally. "You saw that she was hurt real bad." Clements touched her own cheek, sweetly rouged and powdered from going to church. "Yes, I saw." Our eyes filled with tears, and we looked away from each other, down at Clemence's purse as she dug in it for Kleenex. We both let ourselves cry a bit as she got the Kleenex. It was a relief. Then we put the tissues to our faces, and Clemence went on. "It can be more violent than other times." "Violently raped," I thought. I knew those words fit together. Probably from some court case I'd read in my father's books, or from a newspaper article, or the cherished paperback thrillers my uncle, Whitey, kept on his handmade bookshelf. "Gasoline," I said. "I smelled it." "Why did she smell like gas? Did she go to Whitey's?" Clements stared at me, the Kleenex frozen beside her nose, and her skin went the color of old snow. She bent over suddenly and put her head down on her knees. "I'm okay," she said through the Kleenex. Her voice sounded normal, even detached. "Don't worry, Joe. I thought I was going to faint, but I'm not." Gathering herself, she sat up. She patted my hand. I didn't ask her about the gasoline again. I fell asleep on a plastic couch, and someone put a hospital blanket over me. I sweated in my sleep, and when I woke, my cheek and arm were stuck to the plastic. I peeled myself unpleasantly up on one elbow. Dr. Egg was across the room talking to Clements. I could tell right away that things were better, that my mother was better, that whatever had happened with the surgery was better, and in spite of how bad things were, at least for now the picture wasn't getting any worse. So I put my face down on the sticky green plastic, which now felt good, and I fell back asleep. Chapter 2. Lonely Among Us. I had three friends. I still kept up with two of them. The other is a white cross on the Montana High Line. His physical departure is marked there. I mean, as for his spirit, I carry that around with me in the form of a round black stone. He gave it to me when he found out what had happened to my mother. Virgil Lafrenet was his name, or Cappy. He told me that the stone was one of those found at the base of a lightning-struck tree, that it was sacred. A Thunderbird egg, he called it. He gave it to me the day I went back to school. Every time I got a pitying or a curious look from another kid or a teacher that day, I touched the stone Cappy gave me. It was 5 days since we had found my mother sitting in the driveway. I refused to go to school before she came back from the hospital. She was anxious to get out, relieved to be home. She said goodbye to me that morning from my parents' bed in their upstairs bedroom. "Cappy and your other friends will miss you," she said. I should go back to school, even though there were just over 2 weeks left until summer. When she was better, she would make us a cake, she said, and sloppy joes. She had always liked to feed us. My other two friends were Zach Peace and Angus Cashpaw. Back in those days, the four of us were more or less together whenever it was possible, though it was understood that Cappy and I were closest. Cappy's mother had died when he was young, leaving Cappy and his older brother Randall and his father, Doe Lafrenay, to a life that had worn itself into bachelor grooves and a house of womanless chaos. For although Doe became involved with women from time to time, he never did remarry. He was both a janitor of the tribal offices and, on and off, the chairman of the tribe. When he was first elected in the 1960s, he was paid just enough money to take his janitor job down to half-time. When too exhausted to run for a term, he picked up extra hours as the night watchman. It wasn't until the 70s that the feds put money into tribal government, and we started figuring out how to run things. Doe was still chairman, on again, off again. The way it worked was people voted Doe into office whenever they got mad at the current chairman. But as soon as Doe was in, the buzz began, the complaints, the gossip machine, the inexorable teardown that is part of reservation politics and the lot of anyone who rises too far into any spotlight. When it got bad enough, Doe would decline to run. He packed up his office, including the tribal chairman's stationery that he always had printed on his own dime, Doe Lafrenay, tribal chairman. For a few years, we'd have lots of drawing paper at Cappy's house. Inevitably, his successor went through the same treatment. Eventually, Doe's contrite and pleading constituents would work on him until he threw his hat back in the ring. 1988 was an out-of-office year for Doe, which meant he did a lot of fishing with us. We'd spent half the winter in Doe's ice house, pulling in northerns and sneaking beers. Zach Peace's family was split up now for the second time. His father, Corwin Peace, was a musician on perpetual tour. His mother, Carlene Thunder, ran the tribal newspaper. His stepdad, Vince Madwayson, was the tribal police officer who had interviewed my mother. Zach was almost a decade older than his baby brother and sister because his parents had married young, divorced, then given it a second try and found out they were right the first time they divorced. Zach was musical like his father and always brought his guitar to the ice house. He said he knew 1,000 songs. As for Angus, he was from a part of the reservation that was hardcore poor. The tribe had acquired the money to put in subsidized project housing, large, tan, city-style apartment buildings just outside of town. They were surrounded by hummocks of weedy earth, no trees or bushes. The money had run out before steps were built, so people used ramps of plywood, or just hoisted themselves in and jumped out of their houses. His aunt Star had moved Angus, his two brothers, her boyfriend's two children, and a changing array of pregnant sisters and binging or detoxing cousins into a three-bedroom unit. Aunt Star managed an epic amount of craziness. It didn't help that besides no steps, the building itself was a low-bid nightmare. The contractor had skimped on insulation, so in winter, Star had to keep the oven on all night with the door open and the water in the kitchen trickling, or the pipes would freeze. There were rags stuffed between the walls and windows, because the sheetrock had shrunk away from the cheap John aluminum combination storm frames. The windows soon fell apart, lost their screens, nothing worked. The plumbing kept backing up. I even became an expert in sealing the toilet with wax and duct tape. Star was always bribing us with fry bread to do house repairs or rig up satellite reception off a dented hubcap or some such thing. Actually, once she had taken up with her big love, Elwin, we did manage the satellite. Star had a fancy television bought with the one lavish bingo win she'd managed in her lifetime. Together with Elwin, we MacGyvered some old equipment together and got signals from Fargo, Minneapolis, even Chicago or Denver. The satellite was hooked up in September of 1987, just in time for the season premiere of all of the network shows. We improved reception to the point where we sometimes even got the show syndicated out of certain cities, ever changing according to the weather and the magnetism of the planets. We had to hunt them down, but I don't think we ever missed one episode of Star Trek. Not the old one, but the next generation. We loved Star Wars, had our favorite quotes, but we lived in TNG. Naturally, we all wanted to be Worf. We all wanted to be Klingons. Worf's solution to any problem was to attack. In the episode Justice, we found out Worf didn't enjoy sex with human females because they were too fragile, and he had to show restraint. Our big joke around pretty girls was, hey, show some restraint. In Hyde and Q, the ideal Klingon girl jumped Worf, and she was grotesquely hot. Worf was combustible, noble, and handsome, even with a turtle shell on his forehead. Next to Worf, we liked Data because he mocked white people by being curious about stupid things that the crew would do or say. And because when gorgeous Yar got drunk, he declared himself fully functional and had sex with her. Wesley, the one you'd think we'd identify with, our age and a genius, and with a careless mom who let him get into trouble, did not interest us because he was a bumbling white town baby and wore ludicrous sweaters. We were in love, of course, with the empathic half-betazoid Deanna Troi, especially when the show let her hair go long and curly. Her jumpsuits were low-cut, her red V-belt pointed you-know-where, and her big head and short curvy body drove us wild. Commander Riker was supposedly hot for her, but he was wooden, implausible. Better once a beard hid his baby cheeks, but we still wanted to be Worf. As for Captain Picard, he was an old man, though a French old man, so we liged him. We also liked Geordi because it turned out he was always in pain because he wore the eye visor, and that made him noble too. The reason I go into this is that because of this show, we set ourselves apart. We made drawings, cartoons, and even tried to write an episode. We pretended we had special knowledge. We were starting to get our growth, and were anxious how we'd turn out. In TNG, we weren't skinny, picked on, poor, motherless, or scared. We were cool because no one else knew what we were talking about. The first day I went back to school, Cappy walked me home. It is unusual to see people walking places on the reservation now, except on the special walking pass created to promote fitness. But in the late 80s, young people still walked places. And as both Cappy and I lived less than a mile from school, we often flipped a coin to see whose house we'd go to. His was livelier, as Rando always had his friends around, but mine had a television and box so that we could play Bionic Commando, a game we were fanatical about. Cappy had given me the Thunderbird egg in the school hallway, and he told me about it on the way back to the house. He said that when he had found it, the tree was still smoking. I pretended I believed him. Without saying anything, it was clear that Cappy was just walking me home and would not go inside. I would not have let him anyway. My mother didn't want anyone to see her, although my father was about to take a leave of absence and had called in another judge from retirement. He was still finishing up some paperwork at his office. He had already told me that he'd keep checking in all that day, but that my mother would be glad when I got home. As we walked up the drive, Clements came out the front door and said she'd got a call from a neighbor that Mushum was out in the yard. I assumed from a rush that he'd left his pants in the house. She got in her car and swerved away. Cappy turned around for his own house once we reached mine, and I walked to the back door. As I rounded the corner, I saw the twiggy treelets with their shriveled leaves still laid out in a row on the concrete to die. I put down my books and gathered them up one by one and stashed them at the edge of the yard. It was in me at the moment to feel sorry for the little trees and to be aware also that I dreaded going into my house. I had never felt that before. Then I tried to open the door and found it was locked. I was so surprised at first that I kicked at the door thinking it was stuck. But the back door was really locked, and the front door locked automatically. Clements had probably forgotten that. I got the key from its hiding place and went in slowly, quiet, not banging the door and slamming my books on the table as I ordinarily would have. On any other day, my mother wouldn't have been home yet, and I would have felt the sort of elation that a boy feels when he steps into his house knowing that for 2 hours it is all his, that he can make his own sandwich, that if there is TV reception, there might be after-school reruns for him to watch, that there might be cookies or some other sweet around, hidden by his mother, but not hidden too well, that he can rifle through the books on his father and mother's bedroom bookshelves for a book like Hawaii by James Michener, where he might learn interesting but ultimately useless tips on Polynesian foreplay. But there, I have to stop. The back door had been locked for the first time I ever recall, and I had to fish the key from underneath the back steps where it had always hung on a nail, used only when the three of us returned from long trips. Which was the sense I had now, that just going to school had been a long trip, and now I had returned. The air seemed hollow in the house, stale, strangely flat. I realized that this was because in the days since we found my mother sitting in the driveway, nobody had baked, fried, cooked, or in any way prepared food. My father only made coffee, which he drank day and night. Clements had brought us casseroles that were still sitting, half-eaten, in the refrigerator. I called for my mother softly and walked halfway up the stairs until I could see that the door to my parents' bedroom was shut. I eased back down the stairs into the kitchen. I opened the refrigerator, poured myself a glass of cold milk, and took a big swallow. It was grossly sour. I dumped the milk, rinsed the glass, filled it, and gulped down the iron water of our reservation until the sour taste was gone. Then I stood there with the empty glass in my hands. Part of the dining room set was visible through the open door. A roan maple table with 6 chairs around it. The living room was divided off by low shelves. The couch just sat outside a small room lined with books. My father's den or study. Holding the glass, I felt the tremendous hush in our little house as something that follows in the wake of a huge explosion. Everything had stopped. Even the clock's ticking. My father had unplugged it when we came home from the hospital the second night. "I want a new clock," he said. I stood there looking at the old clock, whose hands were meaninglessly stopped at 11:22. The sun fell onto the kitchen floor in golden pools, but it was an ominous radiance, like the piercing light behind a western cloud. A trance of dread came over me, a taste of death like sour milk. I set the glass on the table and bolted up the stairs, burst into my parents' bedroom. My mother was sunk in such a heavy sleep that when I tried to throw myself down next to her, she struck me in the face. It was a forearm back blow and caught my jaw, stunning me. "Joe," she said, trembling. "Joe!" I was determined not to let her know she'd hurt me. "Mom?" The milk was sour. She lowered her arm and sat up. "Sour?" She had never let the milk go sour in the refrigerator before. She had grown up without refrigeration, was proud of how clean she kept her treasured ice box. She took the freshness of its contents seriously. She'd bought Tupperware even at a party. "The milk was sour?" "Yes," I said, "it was." "We have to go to the grocery." Her serene reserve was gone, a nervous horror welled across her face. The bruises had come out, and her eyes were darkly rimmed like a raccoon's. A sick green pulsed around her temples. Her jaw was indigo. Her eyebrows had always been so expressive of irony and love, but now were held tight by anguish. Two vertical lines, black as if drawn by a marker, creased her forehead. Her fingers plucked at the quilt's edge. Sour. They have milk now at Whitey's gas station. I can bike down there, Mom. They do? She looked at me as though I'd saved her like a hero. I brought her purse. She gave me a $5 bill. Get other things, she said. Food you like. Treats. She stumbled over the words, and I realized that she'd probably been given some sort of drug to help her sleep. Our house was built in the 1940s, a sturdy bungalow style. The BIA superintendent, a pompous, natty, abnormally short bureaucrat who was profoundly hated, had once lived in it. The house had been sold to the tribe in 1969 and used as office space until it was scheduled to be torn down and replaced by actual offices. My father had bought it and moved it onto the little plot of land near town that had belonged to Geraldine's late uncle, Shemengwa, a handsome man in an old-fashioned frame picture. My mother missed his music, but his violin was buried with him. Whitey had used the rest of the land that Shemengwa had owned to put up his gas station on the other side of town. Mushum owned the old allotment about 4 miles away, where Uncle Whitey lived. Whitey had married a younger woman, a tall, blonde, weather-beaten ex-stripper, who now worked the gas station gas register. Whitey pumped the gas, changed oil, inflated tires, did unreliable repair work. His wife did the books, restocked the shelves of the little store with nuts and chips, and told people why they could or could not charge gas. She had recently bought a large dairy cooler. She kept a smaller cooler filled with bottles of orange or grape crush. Sonia was her name, and I liked her the way a boy likes his aunt, but I felt differently about her breasts. On them, I had a hopeless crush. I took my bicycle in a backpack. I had a battered black 5-speed with trail bike tires, a water bottle, clip, and a silver scrawl on the crossbar. Storm Rider. I took the cracked side road, crossed the main highway, circled Whitey's once, and slid sideways to a halt, hoping that Sonia had her eye on me, but no, she was inside counting Slim Jims. She had a great big flashy radiant white smile. She looked up and turned it on me when I walked in. It was like a sun lamp. Her cotton candy hair was fluffed up in a swirly yellow crown, and a glossy 2-foot ponytail hung out of it down her back. As always, she was dramatically outfitted. Today, a baby blue running suit with sequin piping, the top 3/4 unzipped. I caught my breath at the sight of her t-shirt, a paler fairy wing transparent tissue. She wore white, unmarred, spongy track shoes and crystals in her ears, big as thumbtacks. When she wore blue, as she did quite often, her blue eyes zapped with startling electricity. "Honey," she said, putting down the Slim Jims and taking me in her arms. There was nobody at the pump or in the store at that moment. She smelled Marlboros, Avion's night musk, and her first drink of the late afternoon. I was lucky. I was a boy doted on by women. This was not my doing, and in fact it worried my father. He made valiant attempts to counteract feminine coddling by doing manly things with me. We played catch, threw a football, camped out, fished often. He taught me to drive the car when I was 8. He was afraid all the doting I experienced might soften me. Though he'd been doted on himself, I could see that. And my grandma doted plenty on him and me in those years before she died. Still, I'd hit a lull in our family's reproductive history. My cousins Joseph and Evelina were in college when I was born. Whitey's sons from